Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today. First, in moments, we'll hear from the urban historian Megan Marslin about the story behind the post-Katrina gentrification of New Orleans. And then just past the bottom of the hour, economist Josh Bivens will talk about the canyon-like gap between productivity and pay. We're a little late getting to the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina's story, but we're not hung up on the news cycle here on Behind the News. The new issue of the online journal Non-Site, NONSITE.com, features several articles on New Orleans and the political heritage of the Moynihan Report, which was released 50 years ago, in 1965. The report, officially known as The Negro Family, The Case for National Action, was originally written for internal consumption by the Johnson administration by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, then on leave from Harvard to serve as Assistant Secretary of Labor. His report would become enormously influential in shifting attention away from the economic and legal causes of black poverty towards cultural ones, notably the breakdown in the family, the rise in out-of-wedlock births, and so on, the now familiar list of alleged pathologies. Job creation and economic development would henceforth take a back seat to programs of moral uplift. The articles in this issue of Non-Site examine the influence of Moynihan's analysis and prescriptions on the response to Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. The hurricane gave city planners an unprecedented free rein to remake New Orleans in the gentry's image. As Louisiana Congressman Richard Baker put it, "We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans. We couldn't do it, but God did." Baker's a Republican, but the sentiment was shared by Arne Duncan, Obama's Secretary of Education, who said in 2010 that the storm was the best thing that happened to the education system in New Orleans. Here's the author of one of those Non-Site pieces, Megan Marslin, to give the historical and theoretical background. She also has an excellent article on the topic on the Jacobin Magazine website. Megan Marslin. We are observing two significant anniversaries. I think celebrating would be the wrong word. One would be the 50th anniversary of the publication of Moynihan's famous report on the Negro Family, and the other, the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And these are rather linked events, aren't they?
Yes, I think they are. And for a lot of reasons, I spent the week before in New Orleans for the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And what was fascinating was sort of the reworking of language into this idea of resilience and making a resilient economy, making a resilient demography, making a resilient city. And part of what was so horrifying and enraging about that is that 10 years after Katrina, the city still has a population where 27% of people are under the poverty line. And I think that part of where that language becomes really effective, this language of resilience, is in its connection to culture of poverty language. So the city officials, policy wonks, academics that have sort of decided to comment on the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina have been able to ignore the real underbelly of the economy that's been created in the last 10 years by linking poverty to individual pathologies. And I think that as we think about this anniversary, we also have to think about how effective Moynihan has been, or the rhetoric that Moynihan birthed has been in removing state responsibility and state action from the reasons behind poverty, and sort of facilitating conversations where, or rhetoric where, poverty becomes an individual behavior. And we've seen that in the ways Adolf Reed has talked about this time and time again in the sort of discourse of the underclass that has been used and really mobilized in the last 10 years to rid the city of public housing. So in the last decade, well, maybe 15 years, New Orleans has effectively seen 85% of its public housing closed. And the rhetoric behind that is a rhetoric of mixed income housing. Let's move people out of these cramped, concentrated poverty quarters and into housing where they are around middle class people with middle class values and that somehow will solve the poverty crisis.
This is like an analysis of poverty that treats it as a kind of communicable social disease, right? Not something that an economy produces or with extensive assistance from the state, but something that originates in people and keeping them in large concentrations together makes them more subject to the illness. Isn't that the analysis?
Right. That's exactly the analysis. And I think that what makes it such an effective policy discourse is that it then facilitates the removal of these people from areas ripe for speculative growth. So for the past 40 years, the Iberville projects, which sit right outside New Orleans' downtown and adjacent to the French Quarter, which is, you know, the vibrant center of the city's tourism industry, have been under attack from the large-scale real estate developers of the city who have really wanted to use that land for other purposes. And part of what becomes very effective of the culture of poverty language is that it disassociates poverty from the political economy that is being created, marshaled, and leveraged by real estate as they move into these other areas. And then it allows you to really ignore what happens afterwards, which is a 21st century removal project, because our wonderful HUD legislation has ended any sort of one-for-one rebuilding, reconstruction of this housing. It means that there's not even that you get these projects that purport to build housing for low-income residents, and they can't even do that.
Well, let's talk some about the Moynihan Report itself. What was in it, and into what circumstances was it thrust?
Right. Well, the Moynihan Report, which was written sometime in early 1965 as an internal policy brief for Lyndon B. Johnson on sort of where the direction of the war on poverty should go, came to the surface in August of 1965 after a series of leaks had sort of made some of the content public. And what the report was really pushing for was, it's very interesting, is because it's called a case for national action, but it actually had no policy recommendations attached to it. But what it did do was sort of utilize a framework, and I'm taking this directly from Ture Reid, utilize a framework that identified institutional racism as the issue facing working class black families in America. But what Moynihan does is connect that to what he called a tangle of pathologies, that poverty and the result of years and years and years of discrimination had actually created a culture unto itself that replicated and reproduced poverty outside of the broader political economy and what was happening with the industrialization and automation and all of these other things. And therefore, it laid out an agenda that proposed discrimination-based fixes rather than economic-based fixes, job training, the support of black families, home economics, which in New Orleans became a big part of the public housing system's fixes in the 1970s. And it effectively ignored any sort of solutions that could have targeted public works, job creation, and identified the industrialization and automation as the causes for unemployment in black families.
This analysis is widely accepted across the political spectrum, even people on the left, but certainly mainstream liberals, conservatives embrace some version of this, right? This is there are various variations, but the theme itself pervades the political spectrum.
Yeah, and I think, I think that's what makes it so effective, right, is that we have those right-wing versions of it that everybody on the left can sort of back away from and say, oh, I don't think that's a good thing to say. But then there are all these ways in which it has been embraced by the left. Think about sort of the moment after Hurricane Katrina, where a series of academics, I believe it started at Harvard, signed onto a letter that basically facilitated a move to opportunity program. And these programs, Move to Opportunity, Hope Six, what has taken the place of Hope Six, Choice Communities, are all effectively rooted within the language of culture of poverty because they take at its core the issue of fixing the mindsets of poor people rather than fixing the economy. And that you do that by deconcentrating people. You do that by moving people to jobs rather than thinking about how immobility and unemployment are vitally linked, and that maybe we need to think about how to bring jobs to people.
I'm speaking with Megan Marcelin, a writer on urban affairs. Yet the Clinton administration loved that business, right? Spatial deconcentration, I believe they called it.
Yes, but I would say it started before Clinton. In 1980, right before he departed office, Jimmy Carter released the National Agenda for the 80s. And basically what the document said was that cities may not be permanent. And that's just coded language for the fact that cities had, by that point, become places of extreme income inequality, right? But the solutions that were proposed were the beginnings of move to opportunity strategies, of sort of looking to the Sun Belt as a measure for why we don't need to focus on older cities, but look to new cities. But of course, that again speaks to immobility and the idea that we're all socially mobile in the same ways with the same opportunities is outrageous. And it ignores the issues of political economy that have been created within urban political economies.
Well, then, of course, this takes us back to Roger Starr and planned shrinkage during the New York City fiscal crisis of the mid-70s. I mean, this has a long history, this idea. My friend Bob Fitch used to call this the bus tickets for blacks approach to urban renewal.
Right. And I think in New Orleans it was happening at that time, too, right? There was this idea that and what I think the New York fiscal crisis does very effectively is shift the tone of both federal and local policy to addressing a fiscal-based crisis rather than an employment-based crisis. And because of that rhetoric of fiscal insolvency, it unleashes the ability to sort of justify policies that support building out a middle class, support building out a sort of back to the city movement, but at the expense of creating economies that are equitable, that provide public services and public resources and social services for working class families. And in fact, the economies that do get created in that post-industrial moment are contingent on the unevenness that they're creating. So in New Orleans, that takes the form of either tourism or real estate development, both of which depend on non-unionization, depend on a workforce that can be mobilized for part of the year and let go for the other part of the year. They depend on low-wage labor, and they depend on the instability of a working-class population.
Turning back directly to Katrina, or actually the overture to all that, the planned gentrification, which accelerated after the hurricane, has roots in earlier years, right? The mayor, Landry, was already had a scheme that got accelerated with the storm.
Yeah, and I think that's actually important to realize in general, is that the trends that were expedited post-Katrina were in play a long time before the storm. And in fact, in a city that's sort of long been considered atypical as a case study of American urban development, it has actually maintained a program that has utilized both federal, state, and local money to support and leverage and insulate sort of private sector sovereignty, both around issues of gentrification and economic development. And these two things are vitally linked, right? You build an economy around stable working class jobs, I mean, white collar jobs, where you have the 1970s that was around sort of the corporate offices of oil companies and hotel management, and in the post-Katrina years that has taken the form of startup tech companies. But you build out these economies that then support and fuel gentrification. And from a very, very early time period, from 1973, gentrification was fueled directly by the local state. And in that, they were mobilizing resources and mobilizing a rhetoric of dispersal, of eliminating poor people from certain areas as a means to sort of create these centers and insulate these centers where gentrification could thus occur.
And the strategies you're describing really have no place for a large population of poor people, without the kinds of skills that this kind of economy requires. But the storm physically removed that population from the city. That was from the planner's point of view, that was a great stroke of luck, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, stroke of luck or planned obsolescence. The storm itself was certainly the result of the federal, state, and local mismanagement of public resources before and after. But yes, it's I believe that the city is now at 80% of its pre-Katrina population, but it has lost 100,000 black residents and about 10,000 white residents, most of these working class populations. And so, yes, it's facilitated the space where gentrification can occur quite rapidly because there are these areas of the city that have been cleared out.
And what's happening now in these cleared out neighborhoods?
I think it was about 2 years ago that New York Times did this sort of wonderfully atrocious piece on the Bywater neighborhood, which has become sort of the bourgeois boheme of New Orleans in the years after the storm, populated by Teach for America residents and in the subsequent years, the startup tech company owners that sort of matriculated out of TFA. And one of the great and horrifying parts of this article was it was a travel article, and they went around and asked people in this neighborhood what the great new things about the neighborhood was. And one of the young new residents said, well, one of the best things are the best places to live are the places that are the most run down. And one of the things that I found most horrifying about that was just the ways in which the local state has facilitated a process in which working class populations cannot come back to those houses, and yet rents have intensified over and over 3-4 times as a result, because it brings because there are new subsidies that allow people to take root there.
I'm speaking with Megan Marcelin, a writer on urban affairs. Now, we're seeing a lot of reports about the entrepreneurial rebirth of New Orleans. One of the interesting things about that, which I only learned from your Jacobin article, is how crucial Teacher America has been to that entrepreneurial transformation. They essentially privatized the entire public school system, laid off a bunch of teachers, brought in Teacher America people, and what's happened since?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was a complete coup, right? After Hurricane Katrina, 7,500 teachers were fired. That's the majority of them black. And now 91% of schools are charter, and they operate around 44 individual networks. And ostensibly, the state had no funds. That was the reason for firing these teachers. And the state said, we actually can't afford to pay teachers anymore, and we are stepping out of this. But that belies the sort of contracts that happened with Teach for America that have led to this privatization. They brought in Paul Vallis, who was formerly in the Chicago School District and before that in the Philadelphia School District, who has sort of been heralded as the guru of privatization. And all of the sort of rhetoric behind charter schools is that there's a different level of efficiency and efficacy in schools that have been taken out of the public system. But certainly over the course of the past 10 years, as education profiteers have either failed to deliver those equitable services, which we've actually seen in the data on schools, that most of the schools are not doing better than the schools that were previously there. And when they are, they come with other sorts of consequences. Charters are allowed to deny students with special needs. They're allowed to deny students who are English language learners. Students are evicted on minimal behavioral issues that sort of then weight the schools as performing quote unquote better, whatever that means. But it's also had other effects because it brings in this whole group of young people who are not there to be educators. And I think this is a really critical point. And I make this point in the article is that as one young TFA student said to me, when I asked about whether or not she wanted to be a teacher, she said, well, no, I don't really want to be a teacher, but I see this as an alternative pathway to entrepreneurialism. And in New Orleans, that is indeed what TFA has become, because it has facilitated in an environment. And if you think about the years after Hurricane Katrina, 2006, 2007, 2008, when the entire nation is entering a recession, your two-year teaching fellowship ends, and suddenly you're in an economy that really cannot support these young people. And yet, here you are in a city where housing costs are low, where the city has basically streamlined its business credential system so that you can really start up a business within a day or two. Startup costs are 30 to 40% less than they are in San Francisco and New York. And it looks as if there's a spontaneous economy, except that these things are being channeled from Teach for America and the idea behind it, which is this sort of entrepreneurial, market-centric education space, to the city, which is boosting and clustering an economy around startups and makes it very, very easy within a stream of tax abatements and tax incentivizations to start a business like this. And so for those who sort of enter that kind of economy, precariousness is a channel to profit. and it takes advantage of the speculative gold rush of disaster capitalism and a political economic landscape, thereby which encourages and undermines the securities of low-income residents. So where precariousness sort of offers these opportunities for Ivy League-educated PFAers to enter the sort of growing precarious economies in new ways that are incentivized by new forms of corporate welfare, for working-class residents, the sort of levels of precariousness that that creates actually undermine and erodes any stability that they had before the storm.
And then finally, this transformation of New Orleans sounds almost like a Richard Florida wet dream. Is this model reproducible? New Orleans is not a typical city. It's got a special place in the national imagination. It's got a very unusual cultural history compared to the rest of the country. Is something like this, this kind of gentrification strategy, replicable in, say, Camden or Detroit?
Well, it is being replicated in Camden and Detroit, and I think barring the kind of severe storm that happened in New Orleans, you won't see that change in the next 10 years the way we have in New Orleans, where New Orleans is now, you know, the number one tech startup city in America. But the fact is that there's a real keenness as to how these sort of opening markets in areas that used to be public sector spaces, the making of public spaces private, the making of public spaces markets like education, like housing, is now extremely profitable. And so this sort of creative economies discourse, which emerged more than a decade ago, almost two decades ago, is experiencing a second rebirth, in that it is taking this new form and taking this new precariousness and using it to its advantage, where there are certainly people that can, because they have access to capital and to networks and to education, can mobilize around these new precarious economies, and that is happening. So Venture for America, which is a company that basically duplicated the TSA model but with tech startups, is now sending Ivy League students to Baltimore and Detroit and Newark, New Jersey. And part of what they are doing, and I just read a very interesting article about what's happening in Detroit, is that they are mobilizing an economy that then feeds a tech startup economy. So, for example, one of the Venture for America projects is flipping houses in Detroit and turning them into rental properties for the next generation of Venture for America folks that come to work in the tech startups. And you're creating these economies that work very well in the kind of national political economy that now exists, except if you're a working class person. And then those kinds of economies that take public sector resources out of the public sector and place them in the market erode and undermine stability and create situations where, for working class people, precariousness means subemployment, unemployment, extraordinarily low wages, drops in real wages, higher rates of child poverty, more and more displacement. And it embraces practices like just-in-time scheduling, where if you are working two jobs or you have children to look after, it creates a whole new level of instability that I think we're just now coming to terms with.
Well, if you're the right class, instability is just an opportunity, right?
It always is.
Thank you. That was the urban historian Megan Marcelin. You can find her articles in Katrina and Moynihan at nonsite.com, nonsite.com, and jacobinmag.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of In a Flood by John Cale from his 2005 album Black Acetate. Next, Josh Bivens, who is the Director of Research and Policy at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Since 1973, productivity, the value of the output of a typical worker in a typical hour of work adjusted for inflation, is up just over 100%, while pay, including fringe benefits, is up by less than 50%. In other words, the growth in what workers produce is up by more than twice what they're paid. Take away fringe benefits, and direct pay is up just 3%, making the gap over 30-1. Why is this? Here's Josh Bivens to tell us more. There's been an enormous gap between the growth in productivity and the growth in compensation, worker compensation, over the last 30-some years. Well, to some people that's controversial, but to you it's not, right? Lay out some of the numbers on this yawning gap between productivity and pay.
Yeah, if you look at the pay of a typical worker, and I say typical instead of average because that's a key part of the story. We sort of use two measures of a typical worker. We look at the wages of production and non-supervisory workers. It's basically the bottom 80% of the workforce, or you can look at the median compensation of the worker in the exact middle of the wage distribution. Pay for those two groups of workers tracked productivity pretty tightly for the 30 years after World War II. Starting in the 1970s, they both became pretty radically delinked from growth in productivity growth. If you look at median workers, productivity grows 72% after 1973 until last year, whereas hourly compensation for the median worker grows less than 9% over that time period. And it's about the same if you look at the other measure, production workers. So a huge gap between kind of what the economy could deliver in terms of the output it was producing in an average hour of work versus what it actually was delivering to the hourly pay of typical workers.
Productivity may be a mystifying or a mystical concept to a lot of people, so could you define it?
Yeah, the simplest definition is it's the amount of income or output. They're supposed to be the same thing. It's the amount of income generated in an average hour of work in the U.S. economy. And when we say income, you have to remember it's not just wages. It's also the profits that you're generating for your employer. So if in an average hour of work at McDonald's, the worker is paid, you know, let's say luckily $10 an hour, but also generates $5 in profits for their employer, that productivity for that particular hour of work would be $15 an hour. Productivity economy-wide averages workers across the economy, looks at all the income they generate in an average hour of work, and that's what we track over time.
Now, this gets a bit geeky, but some people say that productivity is hard to measure these days because there's so much outsourcing going on, outsourcing overseas particularly, and that the statistics fail to capture that. Especially we've seen the slowdown in productivity growth over the last several years, too. So some people dismiss that slowdown because of that. But the broader question, how well can we measure productivity?
I think there's something to that. I think at the aggregate level, so economy-wide, we probably do a pretty good job. I think if you want to look at a specific industry and be able to say how much of output in an industry is due to improvements in pure productivity versus the fact that they can get intermediate inputs from China or Mexico much cheaper than they used to, and so that improves their revenue stream, that gets much tougher, and that's where I think the issue about outsourcing and allocating productivity gains across industries get very dicey. At the aggregate level, as long as we're measuring gross domestic product roughly correctly, and I think we probably are, I don't think calculating productivity at the aggregate level has suffered all that much in recent years.
Well, I think a lot of people who think that the statistics collected by a bunch of dolts, and like the Bureau of Labor Statistics doesn't know any of these things. So they are aware of these things. They're trying to do something about that, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. The BLS are absolutely not dolts. I mean, and one thing we do when we're measuring productivity, we try to account for, I would say the more important thing than sort of mismeasured influences of outsourcing is the fact that more and more of our capital stock these days are actually very short-lived things, you know, basically computers. A big part of what businesses buy for investment goods are computers. They depreciate really quickly. You have to invest a lot of money just to undo that depreciation. And so to get really geeky, the wedge between gross productivity and net productivity actually has been rising in recent years. And if you did not account for that, you would definitely overstate productivity growth. When we make our calculations, we absolutely track, you know, net productivity. So after depreciation, I think that's a much bigger deal than the offshoring issue. And it's one that the, BLS has some good series to help you track and make that correction.
On the other side, the pay side, there are critics who will say that the pay measures you use are wrong. Now, there's certainly many different measures of pay you could use. There's the one that comes in every month with the employment report, which is direct pay. It doesn't include fringe benefits. Then, of course, there's the compensation measure, which includes fringe benefits as part of the productivity series. And then you mentioned earlier whether you use the non-supervisory workers or the entire workforce. What are the relative merits of all these different measures of pay, and how does your story stack up depending upon which measure you use?
Yeah, so the one sort of caution there that is very well taken and that informs our work is the idea that you have to track overall compensation, not just wages. People make a non-trivial portion of their total compensation from employer-provided benefits. We absolutely track compensation. Basically, we take the wage data, which comes every month for production workers, and we multiply that by the ratio of total compensation to wages in the economy at large, which is also data that comes pretty regularly every quarter. And so that way, we're capturing the growth of benefits. Yeah, one thing I'll say about the growth of benefits, in the era where productivity and pay really delinked after 1979, benefits aren't a big part of the story. The story about benefits growing a lot as a share of total compensation is really a story of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when pay and productivity actually grew in line much more, whether you look at wages or compensation. So we track compensation. It's not just wages. It's not quite as big a deal as people say, but we do it. I think the really important thing is we look at what we call typical workers, the bottom 80% or the worker in the median. If you just track the average, you're including incredibly high-paid executives and CEOs. And in fact, it gets worse than that because sort of stock options and performance-based bonuses of CEOs actually get classified as wages in the official data. So average wages track productivity much more closely than the wages of typical workers, and that's because the very top has seen such extraordinarily large gains. And so we think tracking typical workers, most of the workforce, it's a very different thing than tracking the average, and the gap between the typical and the average is the story of rising inequality.
Another critique is that using averages, which show stagnant or declining real wages, obscures the fact that individual workers over the course of their life experience increasing incomes, so that the average is misleading because it doesn't really represent the experience of real people. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that's an important twist on the story. So it's absolutely true that most people make more money when they're 40 than when they were 25. You just, you know, get better jobs, you have more experience, you're presumably more skilled. And that's been true always. You know, that was true in 1950. 40-year-olds made more than 25-year-olds. It's true today. And so over the course of an individual worker's lifespan, they will likely see their wages grow. But there is no sort of age earnings profile like that for the entire economy. I mean, basically, as some people get older, we get a lot of younger people who come into the workforce every year. And so the average age of the workforce really doesn't change much and doesn't have that sort of strong age earnings profile that an individual worker has. I would say the way to think about our finding that wages have nearly stagnated since 1979 is those age earnings profiles have gotten flatter. So 40-year-olds are not making so much more than 25-year-olds as they used to, and they're starting slightly lower than they used to. That 25-year-old is entering the workforce with lower pay than they used to. So it's true for individual workers. They do almost certainly, most of them, see wage gains over their lifetime, and yet for the economy at large, typical workers in each year in a cross-section in the workforce are not seeing serious wage gains.
I'm speaking with Josh Bivens, who's the Research Director of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. If you graph the growth in productivity versus the growth in wages over the last 30, 40 years, you get what looks like a nice wedge, almost a 45-degree angle or something. Where is that gap going? Somebody's making some money off that, right?
Yes. So most of that wedge is a lot of money going to the very top, and going to the top in two ways. One is there's been a growing inequality of labor compensation. So basically, typical workers aren't seeing much in the way of raises, but compensation for CEOs and corporate managers and maybe some specialists in the medical profession and some very high-paid lawyers, their compensation is rising very, very fast. And so a lot of that productivity growth that is above the growth of wages of typical workers is going to wage earners at the very, very top of the wage scale. Like I said, even some of that is a little weird to call it wages because it includes things like exercise stock options and performance-based bonuses. Another part of the wedge is you see a shift away from overall wages in the economy towards incomes earned by capital owners, people who own, you know, companies, who own stocks, who own bonds. And so it's not just an inequality within labor compensation. It's also a shift away from labor compensation to capital incomes. And then a smaller bit of the wedge, and an especially small bit recently over the past 15 or 20 years, is the fact that we use different price deflators for the productivity line and the compensation line. Basically, prices that we measure compensation with have risen a little faster than what we measure productivity with, and so you get a little bit of a wedge from that sort of technical issue of differential price deflators. It's not just technical. It's a small and shrinking part of the gap over time.
Yeah, and that you mentioned earlier that an awful lot of business investment goes into high-tech items that depreciate rapidly, but the price of those things is dropping like a rock, whereas the prices of consumer goods have been rising, not rapidly, but certainly more so than capital goods. How important is that effect?
So over the entire period, say from 1973 to 2014, that sort of differential price growth explains less than 30% of the entire wedge between productivity and pay. Since 2000, those sort of different price paths explain about 15 to 16% of the wedge. So the big majority in either period is driven by the inequality issue. And we keep that wedge in our analysis because like you say, it's real information. It's not a statistical quirk. I mean, it is a fact that businesses who invest have seen really rapidly falling prices for a lot of the stuff they use to engage in production. You know, computers have gotten really cheap. You know, other capital goods like machine tools have gotten cheap. And yet somehow the economy has failed to translate those lower costs for businesses into lower prices and hence higher standards of living for most workers. I think it's a real puzzle why that's happened, but I think it's really happened. And so it's not data that we just want to toss out the window and ignore the way a lot of people want to. A lot of people want to just deflate workers' wages by the prices businesses pay. And, you know, you're sort of giving them a de facto raise in your Excel spreadsheet when you do that, but they haven't seen that raise in real life. And so we don't want to throw that data out the window.
Yeah, what really matters is what you can buy with your income. So if you're a business, you can buy more because of falling prices. And if you're a person, you can't buy so much more because prices are rising, even if they're rising slowly. That's not an irrelevant point, right? That's not some sort of wonky technical point that we can just wave away.
No, I think that's right. And it does, like I said, raise the question of why is it that businesses have not been compelled to pass on the lower costs they have when they buy capital goods into lower prices for consumers that can actually raise living standards. I mean, you can tell a story about maybe we've seen a growing concentration across American industries, sort of a growing monopolization, and so that competition that is supposed to make businesses pass on any reduction in cost into lower prices is just not there, and it's to my mind, you know, another way the economy is kind of failing to translate overall productivity gains into higher living standards for most workers.
Yeah, that anticipates my next question. Why? I mean, why is this enormous gap opened up? And that's sort of a hint about how it might be closed.
Yeah, so I think that one is pretty speculative. I think there might be something there. I'd love to see more research on it. And then I think that the larger part of the gap, the sort of inequality-generated portion of the wedge between productivity and pay, I mean, to my mind, that one has sort of the fingerprints of policy choices all over it. I mean, productivity and pay really started diverging at the same time we started making lots of intentional policy decisions to shift bargaining power away from low and moderate wage workers. We allowed the federal minimum wage to get battered by inflation for decades at a time without raising it. It's still far below its peak in the late 1960s, even though productivity's up by more than 80% in that time period. We didn't keep labor law ensuring a level playing field given growing employer hostility to worker organizing efforts. We decided to do global integration on terms as unfavorable to low and moderate wage workers as we could get. And really important, we sort of abandoned the aggressive pursuit of genuine full employment and instead made keeping inflation low the key macroeconomic priority rather than keeping unemployment low. And so I think this bundle of policy changes just all had the predictable effect of taking bargaining power away from low and moderate wage workers, and that's why you see the rise in inequality, and that's why people have not been able to claim their traditional share of productivity growth in terms of higher hourly pay.
Curiously, the period of the late 90s, we saw both a productivity acceleration and very tight labor markets, which led to across-the-board wage increases. That was a magical moment that didn't seem to last. Now, the productivity gains have totally eroded, and we're now really in something of a productivity slump. How much does that matter?
I think it should matter a lot in terms of what it tells us about policy, and in particular, as you know, that the beneficial impacts of really tight labor markets. I mean, given that we've kicked away lots of the institutional structures that gave workers some bargaining power, you know, very few workers are in a union now, we've got very little in the way of binding federal minimum wage, that makes it more important than ever to keep the labor market really tight, to keep unemployment really low, to give people some bargaining power against employers. And you see that in the late 1990s, you know, we had unemployment hit 4% for two solid years in 99 and 2000, across the board wage gains. I think given that there is no other thing protecting workers' bargaining power in the form of institutions or regulations these days, we're only going to see wage gains in the short run if we get back to very, very tight labor markets, which, you know, is a key reason why debate over when the Fed should begin slowing the economy seems really perverse in my view. There's zero evidence that inflation is around the corner. Wages are just flat on their back. We know that we need super low rates of unemployment to get wages off their back. So to me, that experience in the late 1990s should definitely inform us in terms of, you know, you can get genuine full employment and you actually have to get it for most workers to see anything like robustly rising wages.
But the labor market was tight when productivity was growing 3% or more in the late 90s, and now it's growing close to zero. Does that matter?
To my mind, it matters mostly in that the acceleration of productivity growth in the late 90s was useful in convincing the Fed that they could experiment with low rates of unemployment without worrying so much about inflation. To my mind, we could make the same argument today to the Fed that, you know, for one thing, productivity, it's slowed down a lot. It's still running, it's running faster than wages because wages are actively shrinking in inflation-adjusted terms over the past couple of years. So the idea that, you know, wages are going to threaten to go above the level of productivity and push up costs that way, I think we're really far from. And I think the lesson of the late 1990s shouldn't be that you can only have low unemployment when productivity is high. I think it should be more you can experiment with low unemployment and you don't have to worry that inflation is just a couple months of low unemployment away from roaring through the economy and sending us back to the 1970s. I think the high productivity of the late 90s, you know, again, it was useful to convince the Fed to experiment with lower unemployment, but we got the low unemployment, we got the wage gains, we did not get the inflation, and so that to me says we can do that experiment again, even with the lower rates of productivity. And I actually think productivity will improve a bit if we get tighter labor markets. Like one way you convince businesses to make efficiency improvements and to boost their productivity is to make labor a bit more expensive and make them more careful with how they use it.
That was Josh Bivens, Research and Policy Director of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. A footnote to his observations about the minimum wage. Today, the federal minimum is $7.25 an hour. Adjusted for inflation, the peak value of the minimum wage was $11.17 an hour in 1968. It's down about 35% since then. Then, the minimum was 58% of the average wage. Today, it's 34%. Progress. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Geld, Money, by the German band Melodia from the early 1980s. It's all about how money is our religion. Till next week, bye.